This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
Welcome to the GHIL podcast. I'm your host, Kim Koenig, and in this episode, we sit down with Ulrike Lindner, Professor of Modern History at the University of Cologne, to talk about the research behind her lecture on epistemic inequalities in the Global South and their role in reproducing social hierarchies. Drawing on archival work on the International Labour Organization and its discussions of so-called native labour in the 1920s, we explore how she traces the exclusion of black experts, the authority granted to European imperial insiders, and the ways these knowledge practices shaped ILO policies on colonial and forced labor in the decades before the Second World War. Welcome to the GHIL podcast. My name is Kim Koenig, and today I am joined by Professor Ulrike Lindner and my colleague Dr. Thomas Karl from the GHIL, and we are talking to Professor Lindner about her GHIL lecture about epistemic inequalities and their consequences, the International Labour Organization and its treatment of colonial workers after 1919. Thank you for joining us today. And I would like to jump right in and ask a bit of an understanding question for our listeners who might not be familiar with the term epistemic inequalities. You center epistemic inequality in your work on labor inequality and labor exploitation. Why is this perspective important? What is it? And how does that reveal something that focusing on other types of inequalities might miss?
Yeah, first of all, thank you for inviting me. It's really nice to talk a bit about my lecture. And epistemic inequalities, that looks at sort of inequalities of approaches to knowledge, who is able to approach which knowledge and who is not able to gain certain knowledge parts. And this has often a great impact on how things are discussed, and also to look at who is able to discuss something. So if you have certain members excluded from a discussion, then the type of discussion will change. And epistemic inequalities looks at the effects of such aspects of inequality, whereas normally, I mean, if we hear inequality, it's normally social inequality, or it's inequality of income or inequality of education. But epistemic inequality focuses especially on these aspects of gaining knowledge or aspects of inclusion and exclusion of certain people who are not allowed to contribute to certain discussions. And I think that is the main thing.
Your research, Professor Lindner, reveals a striking paradox. The International Labour Organization was created specifically to protect workers and to reduce labour exploitation, yet as your work shows, it actually sometimes reproduced some of the very inequalities it aimed to address. If we look at that through this lens of epistemic inequality, what would you say is the mechanism behind that apparent paradox?
I think that that is exactly what we tried to analyze. And of course, the ILO did help with inequality, but it was most effective for certain groups of workers, and that were sort of white industrialized workers. And from the beginning, the ILO had a problem with certain groups, with workers in colonial dependencies, with people, with indigenous people, and with all these people who were not under direct legislation of nation states that were part of the ILO, but who were sort of subjects of colonial dependencies of certain states. And there you had exemptions from the beginning. And this was, the ILO was an organization that depended mainly also on the goodwill of the states that joined it. And of course, many colonial states didn't want such organizations to operate in their colonies. So that was from the beginning, it was a problem. And that was sort of an institutional problem. But additionally to it, there was an epistemic problem because sort of racist prejudices were quite widely present even amongst the social reformists of the International Labour Organization. And this hindered them to include experts that might sort of really focus on these problems. And I have looked at certain examples where this is very prevalent and foregrounded. Yeah.
Yeah, you just mentioned that you look at specific examples. Your research often tries to recover voices that were systematically excluded from official records. So I'm wondering about your methodology and kind of the work with sources. When you're working in archives created by colonial institutions, how do you approach finding evidence of what marginalized actors were actually proposing or demanding? Mm-hmm. And what kind of strategies help you work against this specific bias? As racialized bias, archival bias that you just mentioned.
And then one case that I also presented in the lecture, it was quite a famous Black activist, Du Bois from the United States, and he had a correspondence and he also published things, so it was easy to recover his voice. He tried to get into the ILO and to convince the ILO to have a Black representative in this commission on so-called native labor, on colonial labor. And one would find that in some of the correspondences if you grew sort of went deeper into the ILO archive. That was relatively easy, yeah, because he is quite a prominent figure and it was on a sort of a discursive level. But if you go to the colonies and you want to find some representatives of workers, then it's, of course, very hard because if you go to plantations, then you have written records of the plantation manager of the colonial state that sort of controls some of the plantations. But sometimes you have also these plantation managers write about problems on their plantations, and then you get some hints at the workers, and sometimes you also have names because some people go to court and complain about something, or there are some court records, and you have sometimes memories of missionaries who then are in a certain situation and observe what's going on a plantation, and then you have again sort of a hidden source. But often it's very hard to find sort of the voice of colonial workers during that time. Later it gets easier. In the 1920s, it's easier when people start to have unions. And then they, of course, have also written documents where they write down what they want to have and what they need and so on and so forth. But sort of during the period of high imperialism, it's relatively problematic. Later on, you will find more. And it also depends which country. In Africa, in sort of tropical Africa, it's harder. In South Africa, you have a better press landscape. And also in India, you have a very good press landscape very early on. So you also have there some printed versions of reports and certain also memories of some of these workers, but it's relatively difficult.
As you've just explained, your research documents what Du Bois and also the Pan-African Congress were proposing for international labor protection, and when you look at that and compare it to what the ILO then did in reality, what was specifically lost because these voices were excluded from the discussion? So what's the epistemic value that got lost? Can you specify that for us?
Yeah, I think that is, in some cases, it's quite clear. I mean, Du Bois wanted to have a Black representative on this committee. And in the end, I mean, this proposal was sort of lost in the correspondence. It was never taken up again, even if we proposed it to the directorate in Geneva and also to the International Labour Conference. But instead, sort of the nation states proposed experts from their own ranks, and that were, of course, colonial representatives, and they were experienced colonial administrators, most of them quite racist, and who were, of course, in the eyes of their own states, experienced in colonial matters, but certainly not voices who would propose better treatment of workers. But in the end, sort of, for the ILO, the experts Du Bois proposed were rather far away, yeah, from their own experience. Their experience was sort of an imperial benevolence. The administrators in the ILO were mostly British people, and they were part of societies that had campaigned for the abolition of slavery and also for the better treatment of indigenous people, but they were not black activists, right? That was a completely different form of organization. They were not used to these people, and in the end, they rather had their own imperial brethren in these committees. And also, of course, the nation states had rights to send people into these committees, and they would never send such experts, but they would rather send experts that would support their own colonial interests. So that comes together, right? It, different things come together, and it's sort of a not knowing other kinds of knowledge and not knowing racism, not knowing what it is like to be a black person, that all comes together.
So if I understand you correctly, it's what you're looking at, epistemic inequality is more of a structural problem rather than just a representation problem, because Du Bois and other black anti-colonial activists would have probably not been deemed authoritative experts on the topic itself, probably.
Yes, but I mean, there were experts. There was even, he proposed someone who was quite well known, and he was he knew a lot about labor issues in the US, and he would have been very good, yeah. Mm-hmm. But he was not attuned to this sort of imperial circuit where these people were in, who sat in the key positions at the ILO. I mean, one has to say that racism wasn't seen as such a problem as it's seen today. I mean, it was only in 1944 that the ILO changed its outlook generally on race. And in the 20s, when it was founded, it was still sort of an in-between issue. And it was, in some ways, it was hard to address.
Yeah, so racism was more an invisible epistemic power. Yeah. I always ask this question or something along those lines. Looking at your research that's asking why these attempts at increasing equality often generated more durable inequalities, and the case of the ILO highlights this paradox. When you look across your research about colonial labor systems and international institutions, knowledge production, do you see this pattern repeating? And how does understanding epistemic inequality help us recognize when this is happening?
Yeah, I think it's quite obvious also in other cases. For example, if you look at work management in African states, that they invite international companies that they would offer cheap labor to them, right? And in a way, this is seen as helping people getting jobs. But in the end, it increases inequality immediately, because the jobs are so low paid that they are beyond the existence minimum. And you have that, it's called for the policy of abundant labor in Ethiopia, for example. You have that, you had that during the last 10 or 15 years. And it's a similar concept. It's sought to help with unemployment, but in the end, it increases inequality, and especially because it doesn't address the circumstances and it doesn't address the problems that people have who then get these jobs. And it's there are big concepts at sort of addressing certain problems, but generating then other problems. And I think what you can learn is that you have to look very carefully at these huge concepts that are then introduced in some states or in some international institutions. And you have to look at the side effects beforehand. And that is often not done, even if research is there, right? I mean, if it's well known. But I think that's also some sort of epistemic inequality, that some knowledge is just avoided. And mm-hmm. and that is, I mean, you have that very, very often, not only in labor policy, but also in other realms of policy where just knowledge is avoided. I mean, you see that today. If you look at the Trump administration, then a lot of experience is intentionally avoided all the time. I think that is something where you find, but I mean, if it then helps to point out that this is epistemic inequality, that is of course a question, because it just helps analyzing certain processes. But in the end, what you need is a change in policy, and that is hard for historians to create that, one has to say, unfortunately.
That's true. But hopefully putting your research out there and having these kind of conversations with us does a little bit towards that. So thank you very much for joining us on the podcast today. And we really enjoyed talking to you, and hopefully our listeners will enjoy listening to the interview and, of course, also your lecture, where they will learn much more. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.